Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series written by Robert Jordan. There are currently 11 novels in the main series as well as one prequel novel.
Sadly, in September of 2007, as he was working on finishing the series, Robert Jordan lost a long and hard-fought battle.
However, despite the loss of its creator, the wheel turns on. Harriet Rigney, Mr. Jordan's widow and chief editor, has appointed noted author Brandon Sanderson to complete the final novel entitled A Memory of Life.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Welcome, everyone, to The Fourth Age, a podcast about The Wheel of Time brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, as always, am Andrew Gellos, and with us, though a bit under the weather this time, is Carrie.
Hey, everybody. Excuse my voice throughout this whole thing. Sorry, I apologize now.
Also joining us this week, as always, is Virginia.
Hi, everybody. Well, welcome back to Carrie. We're so glad to hear from you.
And once again with us, last but certainly very not least, we have Mark with us as well.
Thanks, Andrew, and hello, everybody. And again, special hello to Carrie.
That's great. I'm glad we got to do this.
Me too.
Agreed.
Definitely. So on our last podcast, we discussed the geopolitical ramifications of the last battle on the inhabitants of the Third and the upcoming Fourth Age. We're going to continue that general topic with one of the largest geopolitical subgroups in the entire Wheel of Time, that being Channelers.
Okay, so our topic for the day is the geopolitical effects of Ptarmigan on the Channelers, which are basically the only group that we really didn't cover in our last discussion.
Just a reminder to everybody that we will be talking about spoilers. We will be ruining almost anything you can think about the series. If you haven't managed to finish reading it, we will talk about everything from books 1 through 11 and the prequel novels. So if you haven't finished reading them and don't want us to ruin it for you, please turn off the podcast.
Right. We'll be talking about even everything in the White Book and maybe even the strike at Shael Ghul. Who knows? So we're going to be talking about our take on the fate of the White Tower, the Black Tower, and the various factions within the Ashaman and the Aes Sedai, and also the various other channeling groups and how we think that they might align. We have the Kin and the Windfinders, the Aiel Wise Ones, the Shan Chan with the Damani and Soldam, and even the tattooed Ayad channelers in Kodansan, including the lovely Shaboan and Shabote that Grendel kidnapped, unless she's gotten rid of them by now. And so we're kind of wondering who's going to win, who's going to lose, who's going to ally with who, and who will just wither and die and fade away at the end of all this. What do you guys think?
My first thought on that would be that Elida, she's going down. I mean, Egwene promised that. Egwene swore that. The rebels swore that, even though they ended up having a couple of traitors in their midst, but that's kind of beside the point. But Elida's going down. Egwene will sit on the Ammerlin seat. What happens after that, I can't quite say, but I do personally believe that she will take over, the rebels will come back in, they'll merge, they'll do what they have to do to survive, and then from there, who knows?
She's definitely going down. I don't think it can go any other way. And I think that it would be fitting for her if we saw her off somewhere on a farm, you know, up to her knees in whatnot, I'm not going to say, on air. And I think that would be the way it's going to end for her anyway, with Egwene sitting up as the Ammerlin, and then the White Tower will be united as one and be able to fight.
Oh, that's one of my fondest desires. I so hope that happens. I really want to see Elida up to her knees in various different animal byproducts. Please let it happen.
Oh yes, that would be something worth reading.
I think what I said about Elida was that I don't know whether her problem is that she's Black Aja or it's just a combination of stupidity, arrogance, and being brushed with Padenfane and Ordis evil as opposed to being actually a shadow brother turned to the Dark One, you know. She's just unbelievably stupid.
And that's putting it mildly. I mean, Elida is the embodiment of I think I'm the best combined with dumb blonde combined with superiority complex.
I also will say that I think Elida is probably taking a dive in this last book. I've kind of had the slight hope that she'd somehow show up at Ptarmigan and end up getting killed myself. But as much as I want to see Elaine as the amazing, strong Ammerlin with the entire tower united. I'm taken back a little bit to the dream that Egwene had, where the ravens flew past the oil lamp, which symboled the White Tower, and it toppled, or tottered, rather, and from it there were little oil droplets that fell off and sprouted their own little flames. And I don't think we've actually seen that happen yet. Yes, we have the rebel Aes Sedai, but I honestly think that something within the Shan Shan attack on the tower is probably going to cause channelers to kind of be thought in a slightly different way, and that maybe everyone who would have been considered Aes Sedai in the Third Age will no longer be considered Aes Sedai in the Fourth Age, and we might have multiple new channeling groups springing up that originally started in the White Tower as the result of that impending attack.
I'm pretty sure that there are going to be multiple combinations of new channeling groups after Tarmon Gaiden. I would sort of see the Shan Shan attack as being perhaps the catalyst for another purge of the Dark Friends and Black Aja in the White Tower, and possibly, you know, combined with the rebels attacking, just to resort everything out. There are going to have to be a lot of Aes Sedai thrown out of the tower for one reason or another, no matter who wins, whether it's Elida or Egwene, because they're just all at odds with each other. And I'm presuming, because of some of Min's viewings, that the Shan Shan may actually capture a few of them. And who knows how that's all going to work out. But I think all that's going to happen before the last battle, actually.
Now, I do want to make a proviso on my own statement, because just as I finished saying that, I was reminded of one of Elida's foretellings, because we know it's always been spotty with her, and it's never been wholly reliable, because she usually twists it to make her look as good as she possibly can. But I do think that Egwene is going to have a united tower under her, because Elida's foretelling was that, you know, the tower will come together under the Emerlin, and the dragon will quake beneath her wrath. And I feel that Emerlin isn't Elida. It very obviously is probably going to be Egwene, just because she's always been able to get to Rand. She's always had that effect and that pull over him. So I think she's definitely a number one on top of the list in that particular foretelling.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I don't think of her as a particularly angry person, but when her temper is up, I think she can be pretty formidable. Rand's already done any number of things to really annoy her. I believe she still thinks that he's using compulsion on the sisters and Carian, and various other things that he's done that she doesn't know the whole truth of or just doesn't like. She doesn't like the idea of Aes Sedai having sworn to him at all.
The total tangent from what we're talking about with Elida, but it comes back to what was being said a little bit earlier there about just the Aes Sedai and the way they will be at the end of this age and into the next. And it brings the thought of how Aes Sedai had changed amazingly much just from the Third Age to the Fourth Age. I mean, we all remember parts in the books where the various Forsaken are sitting there going, and these guys have the rights to call themselves Aes Sedai? Because everything that they do now is like primitive, like their basic healing before Nynaeve's healing, the new way. The old way that everyone knows was the roughest battle healing that every sister was taught just because that's what they needed to do. There was traveling, which everybody and their brother knew how to do. All the technology that's out there is totally different now from when it was, and it's almost like they went backwards. So, I mean, if you think about it, going to the next age makes you wonder, is history going to repeat itself? Are they going to be sent even further into the past, or are they going to end up actually moving forward using the schools that have been developed and the technology and ideas that way? Just a thought. What's your questions and thoughts on that?
Honestly, I've kind of seen it going both ways in my mind, where you see them falling backwards and the wheel kind of starts again and everything just keeps going around. But then I've also imagined it, usually I don't imagine things both ways, but I've imagined it where, you know, Rand's schools continue on and all the new generations that are born are all going to be as strong as, like, the girls, our main girls, and just seems like it maybe could go that way as opposed to going backwards, which is what I actually originally thought.
I think a lot of it might depend on whether Elaine survives the last battle or not. She seems to be at the forefront of the innovations, if you can call them innovations, when she's really rediscovering what they knew full well in the Age of Legends, how to make Terengriel and Cyangriel and Angriel and all the different things that use the power. Egwene obviously has discovered some weaves on her own as well, but I don't think they'll both die. But it's going to be up to a few of them, really, to keep progress going after the last battle, and I guess a lot of it will depend on how physically torn the world is. Now, I actually don't really believe that Rand will break the world the way that Lutheran did, because, for one thing, the taint is gone, and there's no reason for him to go any madder than he is, or even recover fully. Not that I think he's all that mad, but there's no reason for any of the men to go mad anymore. So why would the world be broken, at least by him?
The thing is, though, breaking the world doesn't necessarily mean taking the power and destroying the land masses and ruining what we know of the world as it is. Breaking the world could be something as simple as just breaking all the nations and making it into one big nation. So you can call it, as everyone says, Randland, and that could technically be a form of breaking the world. Instead of being Kyrian, Andor, Tyr, Ilion, the borderlands, etc., etc., make it all one big land. That is technically a form of breaking the world.
Exactly what I think it means. I think technically the world's already broken. He's already done that. If you consider all the ramifications of everything that's happened just to this point, I'd say their world and the world that they know of it is already broken, and it's not even over yet.
Yeah, I know that there's the prophecy that Nicola Treehill had about the land divided by the return and the world not done with battle, but on the other hand, the answer that he was given when he went through the doorway to Rangiril was that he needed to, I forgot exactly how it went, bind the west with the south and the east with the north or whatever it was. So I think there's going to be division and yet rejoining as well after Tarmogoyf. And who knows how all these channeling groups will play into making that happen or not.
There's another thing to consider as well, since we are talking about channelers. It should be noted that channelers live exceptionally longer, even when bound by the Oath Rod, than every normal person. And to take into that account, we know that there are 7 ages to the wheel. If we consider that the first age is the age in which no one knew anything about the Dark One or channeling, and the second age is the age of legends, in which the world was broken, the third age being our age, well, our, with quotation marks around it, but our age, and then the fourth age being the first, we still also have to consider that once you get through the fourth age, there's the fifth, sixth, and seventh ages, and there's going to be significant changes in progress or regressions within the One Power, and whether or not it's used and how it's used. And I think it all comes down to a facet of the fact that Aes Sedai do live an amazingly long time. The Forsaken themselves, even though it's been an unnatural thing, have actually lived now to see 2 whole ages, if you really think about it. And not whole ages, but, you know, large segments of 2 giant ages of the world now. And we're, you know, who knows how long people are going to end up living, and who knows what more will we recover, or what more could we lose, but in its place, what will we gain? I think it's going to be interesting to see, because I really do think that the channelers overall are going to play an immense role throughout the rest of the existence of this particular turning of the wheel.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. The other thing that I think that we're sort of ignoring, though, is the effect of the Dark One on all this, and it's something that I hadn't actually considered until really right now. No matter what the channelers do, good or bad, whether they're in the White Tower or the Black Tower or whatever, the Dark One's affecting everything too, presumably. Now, it doesn't seem to be affecting the male half. The male half sighting is acting strangely after the cleansing and doing things. The weaves are acting funny and it feels strange to them. But Sidar also seems to be failing in the last book. The wards are failing. Weaves aren't working the way they're supposed to. Things that they had laid weaves of keeping on are, you know, decaying and getting maggots and all these other things. I'm not quite sure how that's going to play into, you know, the best laid plans of all the channelers that are around. I mean, really, is there any way to prevent it? Is there anything they can do about it? I mean, what good is it going to do for Elaine to keep making and recreating Tarangriel and new weaves and all these things if Sidar is failing? And, you know, are girls going to be able to come up with some way to fix this dissolution? And then that doesn't even go into the reality seeming to tear apart, you know, the waves of, how did they call it, the ripples that they felt in the Knife of Dreams, where reality seemed to be coming apart in little waves. I mean, what's going on with that? And whole villages being absorbed into the ground, just, I mean, villages appearing out of nowhere and people that are in the vicinity being sucked into wherever they came from. And there's a lot of really strange stuff going on, just apart from the dead walking. And all this stuff is going to affect the Chandlers, and even if they have all the best intentions and, you know, the rebels take over the White Tower and Elida's deposed and all is well with the world and all the Red spawned the Ashaman and everybody's happy and getting along, things are really tearing apart in their world right now.
I agree with what you said. I think it's, obviously, it's all related. It's all to do with the dark, I'm going to say the Dark Lord and be called a dark friend, the Dark One's taint on the world. So I think all of that's related. It obviously has something to do with the Dark One's touch on the world, the taint, or his touch, sorry, I was right the first time. And it actually, I've thought about how they're going to do, is there something that they can do? It's supposed to be his, like, what can they do about that? And I've actually had thoughts of them, like, sitting down trying to figure out something. I have no idea what it is, only because I can't actually, like Virginia said, I can't picture them trying to do all these things that they have to do for the last battle. And if everything's going wonky and wrong, I just don't see how they can get it done.
There was something that was mentioned here just recently that struck up an idea with me. We've talked a lot right now about the female channelers. And Virginia, you brought up the Reds bonding Ashaman. And I think we've kind of agreed that in some form or another, the White Tower is going to survive the last battle, despite even the Shanshan attack that is in the works or on its way. But we've seen and we've discussed a couple of times the Black Tower. What do people think about the, what's going to happen there? Right now, Mazram Taim's legion, for lack of a better term, of Dark Friend channelers is immense. I mean, it's essentially an entire coterie of Dreadlords just waiting to spring out and attack the forces that are gathered behind Rand. And then we've got Loghain, who we've been on the fence about for quite a while as to whether he's a Dark Friend or not. Some say one way and some say another. I like to think that he is still on the side of the light, but maybe serving his own interests more than he is serving Rand's. You know, who's going to prosper there? You know, are all the rebel Ashaman, I shouldn't call them rebels, are all the current Dark Friend Ashaman going to be laid waste to in the last battle? Or what do we think is going to happen with them?
I'm of the opinion that Loghain is a person of the light, but I think he's been turned by the combination of 13 Murdral and 13 Dreadlords or Black Aja, just a feeling that I have. I don't really have any proof for it.
I think that Loghain is going to still be walking in the light. I think he still does, not to sort of create a schism between us. I do disagree with you, Virginia. I think that he does walk in the light, has always walked in the light. But actually, it brings me back to a thought one person had said in a previous podcast, where eventually the Black Tower and the White Tower are going to end up merging into another form of the previous Hall of the Servants. And I think that they'll resurrect the Ring of the Tamerlan, and Loghain will actually end up presiding in that seat, or conjunction of seats, because I think it'll be a combination of the Amerlin seat and the leader of the Black Tower, whatever you want to call him. Not the Mihail or Mihail, however you pronounce it. But like the leader of the Black Tower, which I think will end up being Loghain. So I think the two of them, Loghain and Egwene, will end up leading the new servants of all, shall we say.
I could definitely see that happening. And actually, one thing that I thought of just now, which goes back to what we were discussing previously with Green, she had the dream about the lamp, you know, on the glass tower, and the ravens fly by and set the lamp tottering. But right before that, she also had a dream where she walks on a ledge on a cliff, and the ledge collapses, leaving her hanging by her fingertips. A Shanshan woman climbs down the cliff and offers to help. That could be interpreted as though the Shanshan attack and actually help resolve the conflict between the rebels and the Tower Aes Sedai by aligning with Egwene. And that would actually make yet another alliance between, if you quote-unquote, our guys and the Shanshan, because we already have Perrin and the Shanshan and Rand and the Shanshan and Matt and the Shanshan. So, I mean, clearly there are a lot of alliances potentially happening there. As far as the Black Tower and the White Tower, I could definitely see them merging together to become the Hall of the Servants. I don't know that Loghain will be leading them. I kind of wish he would. I like Loghain. I don't want to see him be a Dark Friend, but I don't know. I think he might be.
I did have a little bit of a theory, and I think I've actually discussed this in an earlier podcast. I was always reminded of one of, I think it's one of Egwene's dreams, where she sees Loghain laughing and he steps over what appears to be Rand's corpse. We're not ever 100% certain, at least I've never been when I read the passage, that it actually is Rand's corpse, because I think it says later that the face seems to be made of paper and crumbles away or something like that. But he steps over Rand's corpse onto a black stone, and the thing that always reminds me of that, and I've heard it said that that might be the rocks of Shael Ghul, which I could understand and makes sense, but I'm always reminded of that black block that they have in the tower, or in the Black Tower grounds, where the Mihail steps up to address all of the people. And for some reason, it always just occurred to me that because the corpse of Rand has that weird paper face, is that it's someone trying to be Rand. And by calling himself the Mihail and, you know, being, oh, I'm teaching all of these people and wearing the dragons on his sleeves, Taim is trying to be the Dragon Reborn, even though he knows he can't be anymore. And what I'm possibly thinking, and it's always been my personal thought, is that Loghain's going to kill Taim, and he is going to step up in the white, or in the Black Tower, rather, and he's laughing because, you know, now he has his glory. He is, you know, the head over all of the Ashaman, you know, and whether that's underneath real Rand or not, who can say?
We did talk about that before. The theory was a little different. Like, we all had different theories, but I don't remember you actually saying that you, because you thought that he was trying to be Rand. I always took it as, yes, it's supposed to be Rand, because I figured that somehow Rand was either going to fake his death or something, and that he would eventually, he would be the Mal'hael, or however you're supposed to pronounce that. I definitely think that's going to happen, and that he's going to be the one to lead the Black Tower and possibly merge with the White Tower. I'm just not sure about the Rand and the puppet thing. I kind of have a little different theories on that.
To kind of change the subject a little bit, do you think that any of the other channelers are going to play an important part, either in the combining of the White and the Black Tower, or how they're aligned in order to try and defeat the Shan Chan and obviously fight the last battle? I mean, we've got all these new channelers that nobody really knew about before. I mean, it really, in the last 3,000 years, it's basically been the White Tower. Now, and apart from the Black Tower, we still have the Kin, you know, the kinswomen from Ebedar, and there's 1,000 of them, more than actually all the Aes Sedai that exist right now, and probably a vast number of Windfinders and Aiel Wise Ones, and then all the ones in Shan Chan as well. If they're channelers, I think they're going to somehow be pressed into service, trying to fight the last battle. I think everybody's going to need to step up at that point.
Yeah, I think they will too. Back to your comment about how they sort of cropped up. I really like the way that RJ did that, how he sort of made everyone think that, oh, yeah, there's only very few channelers out there because the spark is being bred out of humanity, this, that, and the other thing. And then all of a sudden, poof, there's the Aiel. Poof, there's the Windfinders. Holy crap, there's a shwackload of Shan Chan coming from across there, and there's a crapload of channelers with them. Holy smokes, where the heck did all these channelers go? Just sort of, I think that's a nice little plug to say that the Aes Sedai way is not always the correct way. And just because an Aes Sedai is said to tell the truth doesn't mean that she's always right in saying the truth.
Right, they can say a lie if they believe it. They can say something that's not true. And I think that Egwene is still going to try to keep the Aes Sedai together as Aes Sedai. I don't know whether that will carry off to the, you know, the male half as well if they ally together and become a new Hall of the Servants. But I have a feeling that she's going to really be in the minority when it comes to being bound by the Othrod. I can't think of many of these other channelers that are going to go for that. Only the real diehard Aes Sedai will. And certainly, you know, none of the Aiel or the Kin or the Windfinders are going to go for that. Well, maybe a few of the Kin might. They do want to be Aes Sedai, but I don't know. And I'm not sure how the Shan Chan are going to work in the Damani with that. I don't know if they're going to be able to keep that up if there are all these alliances with the people on this side of the Arath Ocean.
Plus, you can't forget the fact, though, that with the discovery that all Suldam can channel or can learn to channel, I mean, despite the fact that the Shan Chan society on the other side of the ocean is pretty much in ruins because Simmerhog decided to let chaos rule over there, but even with what we know of Shan Chan society on this side, and with Tuon being as she is and as everything is, it's going to be interesting about all the new changes in Seanchan society with those discoveries. Because, I mean, to be honest, I don't think that Tuan even knows that the other side of the ocean is basically a burning chunk of land where everybody's killed each other. So that means that she and what is left of the, I believe it was the Koren, the Return, is pretty much most of what's left of the also almighty, once powerful Seanchan Empire.
Well, there are a lot of Seanchan left over there. They're just having a civil war with each other, contesting for power. You're right, I don't know if Tuan knows about what has happened to her whole family, who Semirag basically murdered brutally, but she should find out soon because Rand knows, and a few of the other people there know, and they will have some contact at some point with Matt, and hopefully Tuan. And, you know, there's also the fact that so many people now know how to travel. I can't imagine that even a Seanchan in the middle of a war would give up the ability to have instantaneous access to other people on their side by means of traveling with the power when so many other people now know how to do it. I just can't imagine that. That would be cutting your throat as a leader of troops not to take advantage of that when the other guys have it.
I kind of wonder how much of the ever-victorious army did come over. I have to imagine that because they were planning on meeting with Aes Sedai contention, that they would have had to have brought most of their Soldam and Damani. I mean, I'm not 100% on that, but it seems to me that if you're going to go into combat and you know what your enemy is like, or at least you think you know what your enemy is like, you're going to bring your most capable offensive forces with you, including the Ogier Gardeners and your Soldam and the Damani. I mean, that's just one of those things that kind of makes sense in my mind. So I'm kind of wondering, yes, the Seanchan lands are in civil war right now, but how much of that civil war is being waged with people who, for the last battle's sake, are really going to matter?
I'm sure all the nobles are contending with each other in Shandar, but if I were running things, I certainly would not leave my homeland unprotected or my imperial presence unprotected in any way, shape, or form in order to try and conquer or reclaim, in their view, a new land. I just wouldn't do it.
Yeah, but the other thing I want to bring up, and it goes back to what you were saying about traveling there, Virginia. To the best of our knowledge, the Seanchan don't yet know how to travel. That has been a very, very close-kept secret among the so-called rebel Aes Sedai. It actually got taught to the White Tower when Beonin, I don't know how to pronounce her name. I always called her Beonin. When she went back to the White Tower to what she believed was the true Amyrlin seat. But, I mean, the Seanchan, for the most part, have been kept in the dark with a lot of the newer, quote, new weaves that have been out there. Traveling, skimming, the new healing, all these other fancy-smancy things that we've come to know as mainstream. So it's kind of hard for any Seanchan commander to use traveling because, I mean, they witnessed it. The ever-victorious army witnessed it when they were fighting against Rand, but that was the men channeling, so it's not like their Damani could pick it up and learn that weave themselves. Just a thought.
No, that's a really good point, but I think eventually, especially as, you know, more and more interaction happens between, you know, the Seanchan and various factions of, you know, Rand, Perrin, Matt, et cetera, it's going to become obvious to them. I mean, obviously Perrin knows about traveling, male and female, and Perrin actually has Ashaman with him. Sooner or later, the higher-ups are going to know all about this, and of course, you know, Suroth knew because she was a Darkfriend and had access to Semirag and presumably whoever else. I'm sure they're going to become aware of it. Now, how soon they'll be able to employ it themselves, I don't know, but I think definitely post-Stormungandr, they're all going to know about it. Certainly Tuan, may she live forever, is not going to turn up her nose at that ability if somebody that Matt knows is able to take her back to her homeland in, you know, 10 seconds rather than, you know, 6 months on a ship.
Yeah, that's true, and I'm glad you brought up that point. I mean, a lot of them know of the ability, but what I was trying to bring up was that they don't actually know how it's done. It's like, sort of to bring a otherworld analogy, it's like seeing a big, awesome mural on the wall, but not knowing how all the mechanics of getting that mural there happens. I mean, everyone can come by and say, oh, look, that's a mural. But how many of the millions of people actually know how to mix the paint, set it up, design the pattern, et cetera, to make a good working mural? It's a little bit trickier, and I mean, yes, the knowledge is getting spread. I mean, almost all of the rebels know, a bunch of the White Tower people know. Traveling was one of the first things taught to almost every single one of the male channelers, And so, I mean, it's out there, yes, but for use by the Shanshan, I think we're going to end up waiting a little bit longer to see them using it, at least until after some kind of accord has been reached between the Shanshan land people and Rand land people. So, again, just my random 2 Canadian cents.
You don't think any of these alliances are going to result in an exchange of that information? I can't imagine that somebody somewhere isn't going to slip up with that. My thought, I don't know. Could be very wrong. I don't presume to try and know what Robert Jordan had in mind for this. I'm just guessing like everyone else.
Yeah, and that's all we can do here. That's what we at the Fourth Age are all about. Random guesswork, conjecture, possible theories, but we will never actually know until the book is written and in our hands. Which, speaking of which, I cannot wait.
Yeah, amen. So what about the dead walking and all that? Is that going to play a factor in the last battle? That isn't really part of the channeling topic. But what do you think? I mean, what are they going to do with all these weirdities going on? You think the girls will be able to come up with some sort of a solution to it? They seem to be at the forefront of figuring out new weaves and ways to use them.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm not exactly sure how they're going to go about that, but it could just be like a fluke thing. There's a lot of things that they come up with that it's just a fluke to them, and all of a sudden it's there, and they can do it, and they get the idea and the knowledge. They just know, and I think it's going to be maybe a moment like that.
I personally think just because of the way that Robert Jordan is and the way that fantasy works, you toss in a major, major twist on something like that. The answer to, like, the dead walking and the banishment or whatnot of them and the solution to that, just for sheer random crazy theory, that's going to be solved by either one of the Ashaman that's hanging around with Perrin, which, if I remember correctly, is Neald and Grady, or it'll be discovered by Schwan or Leanne.
I'm sort of pinning a lot of my hopes on Moraine coming back from the Elfin and the Elfin with some really, really wild either objects or answers that might be able to, resolve a lot of these issues. I mean, the Elfin and the Elfin are obviously very powerful beings, and their world is folded in strange ways. They have the ability to read the future of certain people. And, I mean, you know, in a quantum mechanical world, if you view the future, you've changed it, basically. Once you've looked at something, you've changed it because you looked at it. Maybe they'll come up with some really cool way to heal a lot of these issues that are going on and make Sidar and Sidine work properly again and put the dead back to rest. I would love to see somehow the Fin become a major part of the last battle. I don't know quite how they could do it, but I think that would be really cool if they could come up with something like that.
Yeah, I'd actually forgotten for a second there about Moraine, and everybody else in the podcast can give me the proverbial air slap upside the head for it. So you're all more than welcome to it. I feel the same way. I want to slap myself upside the head because I'd totally forgotten about her going to the Fin there for a second, and that is a very, very, very good idea.
Yeah, I like that. It's so different. And just think of all the things for that time that she's been there. I'd love to actually just, which we probably never get this, but have a part or even a different book that was just her time spent there, just so we can learn everything that she learned. That would be great.
That would be. Yeah, that'd be pretty awesome. I don't think she's just sitting around knitting, that's for sure. I can't see Moraine not interacting and learning and manipulating as much as possible. If anybody could manipulate the Ilfin and the Elfin, it would be Moraine Damodred.
Amen.
Exactly, that's what I was thinking.
What do you think, Andrew? You've been awfully silent lately.
I've been taking everything in. I do think Moraine is going to be very essential in fixing the rather drastic problems we have. I've always seen the problems with the world, like the dead walking and the weirdness of the weaves with everyone's weaves, being the result of how much balefire has been used. I mean, it has been rampant in even just the last 4 books. I mean, just balefire here, balefire there. I mean, we see it in book 2 out of, you know, the 11 that we have, and it's been so huge a thing, and the consequences of it haven't ever really been really enforced to us. I mean, they have that cautionary tale about how, oh, both sides were using it in the War of the Power, and entire towns, villages, cities were completely annihilated with it until they realized that the pattern was unraveling. And I honestly think that all of that weirdness is definitely that. But I'm thinking, and if I'm right about my wonderful crazy theory that the Finns were responsible for teaching humanity to channel, that maybe they also can figure out a way, and thereby Moraine can learn a way to counteract that effect. I do think as well that once the last battle's done with, it's not just, a lot of people are going to have to go separate ways. If the Hall of the Servants gets reborn, great. If it doesn't, then I think everyone's going to have their own battles on their own fronts. I honestly think the resolution of the conflict in Sandir isn't probably going to happen until after the last battle. For some reason, even though a gateway could take Tuan there, I don't think she's going to have time. I honestly think that the major last battle is right on everyone's doorstep, like starting in chapter 2, kind of on everyone's doorstep. And everyone's going to have to deal with their own stuff afterwards. That, the Windfinders are going to have an amazing time trying to get the waterways of the entire world under control again. I think nature is definitely going to be played havoc with, and that's going to be their main concern, is seeing that the oceans, and even at this point, the rivers of the world are brought under control, because they are the most knowledgeable about working with the weather in that sort of way. I can't yet see what's going to happen with the Ayyad, but I do really think that there's a strong possibility that we might not have a giant buildup to the last battle. It might be a storm, the likes of which no one has ever seen, being just there immediately.
I don't know, because that would be sort of untypical of the way Robert Jordan has handled things in the past 11 books. I don't know how Brandon Sanderson will, but I'm presuming he's going to try and stay as true to Jordan's style as he possibly can. But if you look at every one of the books, he spends like 7/8 of the book leading up to something, and then he resolves the big conflict, whatever it is, Rand being kidnapped or Dumai's Wells or all the other things that have happened. He resolves all that in about 6 pages. I don't know that he can do that with the last battle, but I think it's going to be a long lead up like it always has been. And then the last few chapters will just be the aftermath and the resolution.
Yeah, I kind of see it. Yeah, the way you say that it is pretty good of Robert Jordan's style, but I can almost see, almost just to stand out from his standard of way of writing, everyone will have this huge build-up, the world will be ready, yada, 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 everyone will be ready. They're thinking, okay, we're going to do this, it's going to be next week. All of a sudden, Rand's like, no, it's tomorrow. He goes out, he does what he has to do, everyone's sitting there, yeah, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. Guys, it's already done.
Sure, and I can see that happening too. The reason I push for there being a possibility that it might be very early is that when you really look at the overall picture, the whole story has also been the build-up to the last battle. From book one, we're started on the path to Tarmon Gaiden, and it's been an amazingly long build-up to that battle, and I can almost see it happening just as, suddenly there's the resolution. Out of the now, multiple 100,000 pages of text we've had in the series, suddenly now we've got a book, which is The Last Battle. And I think it's possible. Now, I will fully admit, I am probably wrong. There probably will be a decent build-up, but I don't see The Last Battle being even the last 2 chapters. I actually see there being, I'm probably going to get flapped for this particular comment, an almost Tolkien-esque ending, where the last battle will happen, and then there'll be at least 2 more chapters, where we actually get some of what RJ had intended for the Outrider sequel novels, which talked about what happened after the last battle, and, who of the survivors is functioning and how they're functioning.
Well, we're all expecting this 1,500-page epic with its own luggage cart, which I personally am hoping for. But what if RJ turns around and has the last laugh on us, and it's like that? You talked about it in previous podcasts, Carrie and Andrew, where they did the very, very, very short stories, like Hemingway. And what if the last book is just Reality Unravels, film at 11? Reality Unravels, the Dragon Reborn is stunned. I get the dope slap for not thinking about balefire causing the ripples in reality. That was obvious, and I never thought about it.
Don't feel bad. That's something that when he brought up, I was total loss for.
Yeah, I always thought it was just the taint. I just thought that's what it was.
I actually think that Balefire might be how Rand manages to survive the last battle. I think he'll be killed, and then somebody, maybe, you know, somebody like Nynaeve and Cad Swain and Arishma wielding Kalendor and all the Ungrial and everything that they've collected, and maybe Elaine and everybody get together and linked together. They wield so much Balefire that they take it back in time to where Rand doesn't die.
Now, there's a crazy theory that I think even Ben would be able to go, wow, that is crazy.
Well, how else is he going to die and live again?
And then if they bring the Dark One back, too.
Oh, yeah, that. Well, Balefire's a little more local than that, so he could kill the Dark One and die doing it, and then they do enough Balefire to bring him back, but not the Dark One.
Right. Little flaw with your logic there.
No, it worked. I mean, he didn't bring back everybody when he Balefired Ravine and brought his friends back. Not everything unraveled, just the local areas affected by Balefire.
I'm still in my mind chuckling about how the term Balefired and Balefiring has now become a true verb, not just a noun of a thing, a weave that is prohibited. It is now a verb. You have been Balefired. Goodbye.
No.
You are the weakest link. Balefire.
All right, so here's another sort of topic shift. We've talked a lot about the forces of light and what's going to happen with the channelers at that. What about the opposite side? You know, in the absence of our resident dark friend Morgan, I gotta wonder, you know, who is going to survive out of the known or unknown Dreadlords, and, you know, what's going to be the impact afterwards? You know, if the Dark One is sealed away, or if the Dark One is somehow removed, what's going to happen with those who still follow him?
Are they going to come back to the light, you think? I'm sure Rand would forgive them.
Well, Rand will forgive them if they're female. If they're male, there's a serious chance he will Balefire them.
Who was it? Was it Andrew Miller that was thinking that Lanfear might come back to the light at the end because of Lucerne or Rand?
I honestly doubt that personally. That is almost as crazy of a thought as saying that Rand will turn and worship the Dark One. Just ain't gonna happen. Mieren, whatever the heck her last name is, the woman we all know of as Lanfear, is so dedicated to herself and the Shadow because the Shadow suits her needs way too well, and the Light just doesn't really work for her. I personally see her as either staying with the Shadow or dying for herself and the Shadow.
Maybe she'll sacrifice herself to save Rand at the last battle and so redeem herself?
I still think she's way too selfish to do that. If anything, she'll sacrifice Rand to try and save herself.
I don't know. You know, she was good once. Remember in the visions that Rand had in the Aiel column, you know, the crystal columns that he went into, Myron Sedai was highly respected. And when she became Lanfear, some of the Dashain Aiel that had served her said that Lanfear wasn't always evil. She was good, and they defended her. You know, she was a good person at one time. There's nobody so lost to the light that they can't come back to the light.
Normally I would agree, but the Forsaken gave up their souls to the Dark One so many years ago, so many thousands of years ago, that even trying to come back now, at least for the Forsaken, is an exercise in futility. Now, some of the known Dark Friends, such as the absolutely useless Liandrin, I figure she'll stay as she is, just because that's the way she is. All knotted up, locked up, and not able to do anything. Some of the other of that circle of 13, I think, will end up dead. Some of them will end up coming back. The one who was major good at healing, was that Timael or was that Chesmal?
Semira.
I keep forgetting. No, not the Forsaken. Of the circle of 13 Dark Friends that abandoned the White Tower.
Oh, Timaela and Chesmal.
Yeah, those guys. Timaela and Chesmal. Those two, I think, will end up dead. Osni, I think, will come back to the light.
With their warders, all of them?
Yeah, actually, I think they'll all come back, too. What do you guys think? Carrie? Andrew?
Oh, wait, I've got a fitting fate for Elida. Maybe it would be kind of cool if Padan Fain could do for her like he did for that Murdral and the barn door, you know? It's kind of cruel, but...
You are extremely sadistic. I personally would be quite content to see her shielded like Liandrin and forced to labor for the rest of her life up to her knees in animal byproducts. That is a fitting end to Elida.
Yeah, the barn door's probably too good for her.
She deserves to live. She has to live through that so she can be put through it, because dying is just way too easy for her.
Okay, we'll relent.
I was actually wondering, I would assume, because there's so many, of the Ashaman that are, I guess you could call them dreadlords now, how many of them were turned by 13? So is there going to be a procedure, like, where they're going to be able to tell or just even take somebody's word that they want to come back, and they can somehow bring them back and make them a productive part of society just like they would have been if it never happened? Or are they going to be thrown in, like, a prison or something? How is, like, the whole thing going to work out?
Well, there's two schools of thought on that. Virginia had a crazy, interesting theory. The corollary to 13 Dark Friend Aes Sedai plus 13 Murdral to turn someone to the shadow. She had an idea about 13 Aes Sedai and some other thing. I think it was even possibly Murdral there, too, channeling to turn someone back to the light. I'll let her explain that one in a second. But I think that he might end up doing his, as he was famous for in the first couple of books, his sword slicing through the black cords that bind and bringing them back to the light that way.
Oh, I actually don't remember the 13 Aes Sedai and the Murdral thing to turn them back. I was thinking that one of the girls might come up with some fabulous weave, or perhaps, I don't know, some Tarangriel that might be able to do it. But yeah, probably cutting that black cord would sever them the way he did from Asmodean. Severing the black cord would release them from the shadow up to a point the way it did for Asmodean. It didn't necessarily bring him back to the light. It just cut him off from the Dark One and presumably some of his influence. But that would certainly be a start. I like that.
Yeah, it would definitely be nice to have some procedure to change those who have been turned. The only issue I've got with that is that we don't know who or how many people have been turned. I mean, we do know that presumably at least some of the Ashaman, several hundreds of them, who are allied under Taim and his unknown forsaken sponsor, for lack of a better term, you know, how many of them have been turned against their will, and how many of them maybe we're just taint crazy enough to go, well, shoot, if I can live forever, why not?
Yeah, that's what the Forsaken did, pretty much, as far as we know. I think there's got to be some procedure, you know, for reversing that turning against your will, but it's probably been lost in the annals of Aes Sedai history. That's why I said I was kind of hoping for, you know, Egwene or Elaine, one of the gals that are so good at reinventing these lost weaves, to come up with something. Or who knows, you know, maybe somebody will hand it to them. Maybe I still think they're going to get some information from Semerach. I really do. I think somebody's either going to interrogate her, or Cad Swain will just irritate her to death, or they'll slap an eidam on her, and Nynaeve, who has all that experience with Mogedion, can, or Egwene, who's really good with that sort of thing, can just get some information out of her about all these things from the Age of Legend. I think she's a powerful conduit to all that knowledge that was lost, if they can just dig it out of her. She's certainly going to be a lot more useful than Mogedion. I don't think Mogedion knew as much as Semerach about anything.
That's true. Also, even if she could just explain, you know, go into detail about, if she doesn't know how to turn them back, explain a little bit more of the dynamics that go into doing it, and maybe somehow if they all, they got to be able to come up with something. Because to me, I think that I like the idea of cutting the cord, but I think that might be too easy. I think that's kind of an easy way around it. I think it needs to be something that's like almost like a ritualistic type thing. That's how I see it as.
Like healing Matt from the dagger or something with the Sign Grail or some sort of procedure like that.
Yeah, exactly.
I still think that the slicing of the cords thing is probably one of the only true ways we know to remove a Dark One, or the Dark One's control over you, possession, for lack of a better term, I think we'll use possession there, over you. But in all the cases that we've seen him do that, when he did it against, I believe it was Agenor, or Agenor, as the audiobook pronounces it, when he does it against Asmodean, again, pardon me, my pronunciation is what I have read for the past 10 years that I've been reading this series, all in my head. I never got the audiobooks until very, very recently. So, I mean, all of these, every time we've seen him do that, it's always been in, like, a one-to-one conflict. I'm fighting for my life. The only way I can think of to save myself is to sever you from the Dark One's power control, and we go from there. So, I mean, I can kind of see the ritualistic idea that you're talking about. Although I don't really know if ritual and process is really the way it's going to be.
Something that just occurred to me is, as far as I know, as far as I can remember anyway, Rand's pretty much the only one who's seen this black cord around anyone. None of the women have ever seen it around any of the female Forsaken. Nynaeve and Egwene and Elaine spent all that time with Mogedion, and I don't remember them ever seeing anything like that, even when they were, when Nynaeve was in battle with her in Tangiko. So maybe that's just something that happens with the men, or maybe you have to be as powerful as the Dragon Reborn to see it.
I was wondering if maybe it was a lost talent of some kind.
Yeah,
could
something.
Be.
I had always been under the assumption the black cords were the representation of the Dark One's connection that keeps the male channelers from going insane because of the taint. Going back to the episode where we talked about spirit, I had seen, or I kind of envisioned it being a kind of, like the Dark One put a barrier on the connection to the source that kind of acted as like an insulator, and that the black that we saw around the cord is actually the Dark One's taint just not getting in to the channeler itself.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. Actually, thanks for bringing that up. That's great. Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't, because like you were saying with Asmodean, he explained that eventually he's going to be susceptible to the madness like everybody else because of that, because Rand had cut that cord. Did he not mention that in the books?
Yes, he did. Maybe the female Forsaken and Black Eyes, you just don't need that protection because there's no taint.
Yeah, that was one of the things that, if I remember correctly, a bunch of the Forsaken, when they met after Book 5 during Lord of Chaos, all the Forsaken were there, and Lanfear was all like, well, how do you know the Great Lord's going to trust you when you don't have the protection anymore? And my first thought was, okay, so if he doesn't think he can trust us, who have to rely on his protection, how in the name of whatever you believe in does he trust you, who doesn't need any protection?
Yeah, exactly.
Random thought.
No, it's true.
So, since we're all gung-ho about talking about the Forsaken, will any of them who are still alive survive the last battle?
Well, actually, at the rate that Rand and a few of the others, like Moraine, have been going through them, how many of them do you think are going to survive to the last battle, let alone survive the last battle?
Ooh, good question. I think Semirog's going to last. I think Mesaana's going to last. Grendel will probably last. Demondred will probably last. Arangar and Osengar, well, Osengar's already dead, but Arangar, I think, is going to end up kaput before the last battle.
We don't even know where she is, do we?
Halima ended up vanishing with her...
Delana.
That's it. They ended up going to the traveling grounds and vanishing. So you're right, we don't really know where she is.
If there's any justice, maybe Delana will do for her.
I'd love to see Delana take her out. Just say, yeah, that's it, you know what, you're done. Dagger to the heart, kaput.
So basically you think all the Forsaken are going to survive? Lanfear and everybody? Mogedion? We don't know what happened to Mogedion. I don't think she's dead, though.
Lanfear is going to survive if only just out of sheer dumb luck, stupidity, and perseverance, just so she can try and kill Rand, as she calls him, Luce Theron, again. Because she is that obsessed and that crazy, she will end up doing it. Moradin, he'll survive to the last battle and then get cut down, kind of like, what was that story that they talked about in the warder training about the greatest swordsman of all time, Jerome, and how he ended up getting taken down by some lone farmer with a quarterstaff? I can see that happening to Moradin. Oh yeah, I'm the biggest, I'm the best, I'm Nablis. Oh, dagger through the back. That wasn't supposed to happen.
You're toast. I think that Moradin is going to end up somehow merging with Luce Theron and Rand in some massive
event
prior to the last battle.
That would end up being crazy. I called it a fuster cluck because that just is what it is.
Yeah, that's what it would be.
Because, I mean, here we have the main protagonist and the main antagonist merging into one. That would just totally wreck everybody's thoughts.
Charlie Foxtrot.
That brings more of a question of Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Yeah, but I think that Min has seen the merging of Luce Theron and Rand, and there is already this connection between Moradin and Rand. He can see Moradin, and Moradin's aware of him, much as the connection that he has with Perrin and Matt when he thinks about them, the colors swirl, and he can see what they're doing. So I think that there's some sort of fabulous mystical merging that's going to have to happen there You know, that's not to say that Morden isn't going to go kicking and screaming, but I don't know. Maybe Rand will absorb him the way he did all the mirror images of himself that one time. I don't know. I'm sure there's going to be some really spiffy way for it to happen, though.
Yeah, for sure. I don't happen to think that all that many Forsaken are going to live, actually. I definitely see Samarog living. And for Lanfear, like you were saying, I actually think Rand's going to kill Lanfear. I think that's how she's going to meet her end.
That would be a real breaking point for him. That would be the first woman that he's consciously and purpose killed. Although I have to say that she's probably annoying enough that that wouldn't be hard for most people. I think she could irritate a brick the way she is right now as Sindane.
I'm not certain. I honestly kind of have the idea that most of the Forsaken will probably make it to that last battle. I think most of them will not survive it, but I do kind of see there being a few. And whether they're bound in service afterwards, or whether, you know, a way is found to convert people back to the light, and of course, you know, how awesome would that be to get an actual Aes Sedai from the Age of Legends and turn them back? And in that particular way, maybe Andrew Miller's right. Maybe Lanfear will come back to the light, but maybe it might not be her own conscious choice, because we don't know what happened to Mirren that actually changed her over, really. We know that she went and she made the boar with Beedamon, but, you know, afterwards, suddenly she was just like, I want power, I want control, I serve the Dark One, and, you know, it's very, very possible, at least in my mind, that maybe in drilling the boar in the first place, she might not have gotten converted directly by the Dark One. I mean, that might have been the very first conversion, so it might be the first conversion back to the light as well.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, I like that. I wonder if we should probably talk about this in our, if we do a new Forsaken episode, but I wonder if all the Forsaken are going to proceed in the last battle the way they did during the cleansing of Sidon, where they're all basically running around operating on their own and trying to avoid whatever orders that they were given by Morden. You think any of them will actually ally together and work as a team? Because, you know, I think if all of them had ever actually cooperated with each other, Rand would have been toast a long time ago, and Matt and Perrin definitely would have been gone. And I don't know if they can bring themselves to do it, or if Morden's, you know, bad enough to make them all behave and work as a team. What do you think?
It's very tough to say what's going to happen there, because, as you said, they are extremely independent, and I don't see them putting aside everything in order to work together towards the common goal, when, for them, the actual common goal is to become Nae-Bliss. So it doesn't really matter what else is going on. They're all going to try for that.
Yeah, but if push comes to shove and it's lose the last battle or work together to achieve the victory of the Dark One, you know, they might be able to put aside their personal questing for power long enough, thinking that after they win the last battle, then they can go back to undermining each other with all the glee and abandon that they want, and no Luceferin Telemann Dragon Reborn to interfere with them. Do you think that when the Aes Sedai all, if they do, all ally together at the end and the last battle's won, do you think that they will end up basically ruling the world the way they did in the land of Shan-Chan before the armies of night and everything were in play, where they're all contending with each other for power and ruling or whatever?
No, I don't personally think that. I can actually see them, in the end, after all is said and done, having to be brought down a few pegs. I think it's going to be actually very hard for them to try and rebuild everything, because it's going to be so different from them in the way that everybody sees them, and definitely don't think they're going to be ruling anybody besides themselves. And even there, it's not going to be the same. I think that it's going to be a different level compared to how it was before.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think the Shan-Chan are actually going to be pretty instrumental in that. I think the eventual strike on the White Tower is going to kind of shock a number of the Aes Sedai into reality, and, you know, be kind of that message of, hey, we're sick of you guys pushing us around. Yes, you haven't been ruling, and you've taken steps to make sure you're safe for public consumption, but you know what? You've still been pulling the strings of the entire world. We've all known it for centuries. We're tired of it. We want to rule ourselves. You know, you're supposed to be the servants of all. It's time you start doing some serving.
Yeah, I definitely think the Shan-Chan are going to be instrumental in helping Egwene keep the White Tower, and if Egwene becomes Amyrlin's seat over a new United White Tower, she's definitely going to want them all to be bound by the Three Oaths. She's made that very clear on numerous occasions, in which case they won't be ruling anybody but themselves. So I think that pretty much wraps up our topic for today. We've gone a little bit long, and one thing I want to do before we go any further is thank Carrie so much for not only for being with us, but for battling through this horrible sore throat to try and talk with us. I feel so badly that you're such a good person to try and work through this. Thank you for being here tonight. And also, Andrew and Mark, I really appreciate you coming tonight. It's really great. I know neither one of you have been feeling all that well either, so thank you to all of you.
Oh, no problem. I just want to apologize to everybody for having to listen to me and put up with my voice throughout this whole thing. But I don't actually usually get time off, and because I'm sick, I have time off. So it was an opportunity to get to come on, so I'm really glad that I did it.
Well, we are too. Thank you.
Yes, very, very glad that you can make it, Carrie. And we're trying to figure out a way to work our schedule to get as many of our other compatriots, even if they couldn't be here tonight, which a lot of them couldn't. That should theoretically wrap up most of what we're trying to say today. We've touched on a lot of stuff. We've missed a lot of stuff, so don't rip into us too badly for it. If you wish to get a hold of us, there are many ways you can do so. My personal favorite way, which nobody seems to do anymore, is by leaving us a voicemail. You can do that by calling 1-888-333-7690. And just leave us a voicemail. There's nobody on the other line, unfortunately. I mean, if we could, I would have that phone number forwarded to my phone in a heartbeat so that I could just talk to people. But no, just call in, leave a message. And right now, we're so starved for messages. If you call in and leave a message, odds are pretty good it'll get aired.
Yes, I'm just so anxious for somebody to leave us a voicemail. I really want to have somebody leave us some voicemails that we can put on the show. We would love it. The other way that you can reach us is by email. And that is at podcast@dragonmount.com. And we also have the comments page of the podcast. Each episode has its own comments. You can leave a comment there. And there's also a podcast forum, Fourth Age Forum, on dragonmount.com.
We also have a MySpace page, and that is www.myspace.com/fourthage. And you can leave us comments there and contact us via private messaging through MySpace or just leave a comment on our page.
Yes, we definitely would encourage everyone to get a hold of us any way you can. You can give us praise, which we always love. You can give us criticism, which we always take with a grain of salt, but also can learn a lot from. We'll take crazy theories. We'll take not so crazy theories, or even just, you know, calling to say, you know, hey, or just, you know, chatting us up a little bit, because we love interacting with everyone who listens with us to share, you know, our joy in being fans of Robert Jordan. So I would just like to say for myself, Andrew Gallows, for Carrie, Mark, Virginia, all of whom are here tonight, Jason, Andrew Miller, Jesse, Morgan, and everyone, all of the Fourth Age podcasters, we would like to welcome you officially to the beginning of the third year of the Fourth Age.
Take care, everybody.
Thanks, everybody, for listening, and I hope that you will all be illumined by the light.
And from all of us, Saravia Ninto, Manshima, Aishite.